seems like everybody's got an opinion on just about everything nowadays. When you watch the BizNews WhatsApp channels, there are all kinds of insights that are provided, suggested, recommended. But you got to get to the people who actually know. And a member of our community who knows about what's going on with international trade is Johan Heman. He spent a career, a lifetime in this field, working in the South African operation, the DTI, and then in Geneva, and also for 17 years at the World Trade Organization. So if anybody knows what Donald Trump's up to, what South Africa should be doing, he's the man. Johan, thanks for joining us and for sharing your insights with us. I guess it's not unusual in this day and age, with so much information being available, for people to have opinions on pretty much everything. But from what you are hit with on a daily basis, which we all hit with on a daily basis, how much of this stuff is actually worth listening to, and how much is being driven by some kind of agenda?
Okay, thanks, Alec, for the opportunity. I hope I can assist you in the tribe to get a little bit more clarity of what's going on. Well, that's now from my perspective. Now, just before I start, a caveat, and that is all my comments should be seen in the light that I'm not pro-Trump, I'm not anti-Trump. I'm not pro-China, I'm not anti-China. I'm not pro-WTO, I'm not anti-WTO, but what I am is unashamedly and unapologetically a supporter of a rules-based multilateral trading system, which can create the level playing field for all countries, including the big and the small. That means also for South Africa. Now, there's a lot of speculation going around, and people get a little use very inflammatory language, which I find not very useful. I think one needs to go back and try to analyze the Trump phenomena. I'm not surprised that he's trying to do something. Now, I'm surprised by the way how he's been doing it. Now, of course, we all know that the strategy is you create chaos and then you create something good out of the chaos. And that's what he's been saying. Now, that's all good and well if you can manage the chaos. If you cannot manage the chaos, then it's a very risky game, particularly the stuff that you're dealing with. You're dealing with the whole world. It's not only a U.S. issue. Now, of course, the U.S. Has its concerns and ways of going about its business, but it affects the whole world. That means us here in South Africa as well, which makes it very, very problematic. Now, so there are lots of opinions going around, but you need to look a little bit into the history and to dig into to what happened in the past. This is not something that is new. It's not new. It wasn't new to Trump 1. And it's, of course, no surprise that in Trump 2, he's really ratcheting up his efforts to set things right the way how he sees it.
Johan, let's just start then at the very beginning. You've been involved in this field since 1984. You've served at the highest level, listened to all the arguments. But I guess the place to start is 2001, when the Chinese were introduced into the World Trade Organization. In other words, the intention then from the Western world was, if we bring China in and we apply the rules, they will become part of the rules-based system around the world, and global trade will boom. I suppose that was the intention. At the time, though, many people look back at it and say, hang on, there were big mistakes that were made then. Just help us through them, because you were right in the middle of all of this.
Yes, if you look at you're right, Alec, it's sort of in 2000, 2001, where things started to develop. China was admitted as a member of the WTO in December 2001. And, that was the operational date. Now, of course, there were lots and lots of negotiations for many, many years before they were allowed to accede. And the negotiations were primarily done under the Clinton administration, with Charlene Barshefsky was in the U.S. trade representative there, the U.S. trade minister. And you also have to take into account that that was a few years after the fall of the Berlin Wall, a totally new world. Some people said the end of history. And we also had 9/11, sort of towards the end of the negotiations to allow China in. Now, at that stage, there were high hopes that if you bring China in, the Chinese system was not really at that stage fully compatible with what is required to become a member of the WTO. But the feeling then amongst the bigger players in was that, okay, China is on the right track. They've made the right noises. They've started with some reforms. And they made a big issue in China of rule of law, which was in the legal system of China at that stage, totally unknown concept. So they used that as a tool to bring in a little bit of order into the Chinese system. And what's also interesting is the word WTO, or the acronym, is not translated into Chinese. They use it as WTO, as sort of as a shining light, a beacon for them. Now, of course, so they followed the rules, not fully compatible, but they were sort of good hopes and high hopes that they will continue on the path. And for the first couple of years, that's exactly what they did. They tried their best. But then, lo and behold, what happened was 2008 with the financial crisis. And then, of course, China was also heavily affected by the financial crisis. And then my Chinese friends told me after, say, well, you know, we looked at the capitalist system. We like it. And that's why we go for a Chinese system with capitalistic characteristics, or whatever way how you express it. But when we look back at 2008, we realize that, no, our system is not that bad, and capitalism is not 100% okay. We need a mix. And then they made a little bit of a belt turn, particularly in their state-owned enterprises. And that is sort of, that was the heart of the old China, and it's still the heart of the Chinese economic system at the moment. Now, of course, if you look at a state-owned enterprise, that is allowed in terms of the old GATT rules, the predecessor of the WTO, and also according to the WTO rules. But then you need to act as a fully private company, and you have to follow free market principles. If not, you have a problem, and the rules address these problems. So China then, after 2008, then refocused on their state-owned enterprises. Up to 2008, they privatized a lot of their SOEs. But the big critical ones, they strengthened them, and for very obvious reasons. And then, of course, what the Chinese did, they're very intelligent, very keen students of the legal system. And so they studied all the rules, and they followed the rules very, very carefully. And some of the agreements of the WTO consists of a number of separate agreements, amongst others, the subsidies and countervailing measures agreement. We call it the subsidies agreement for short. There are certain gaps in the provisions of the subsidies agreement as negotiated in the Uruguay round for the WTO purposes, which did not really address the questions that SOEs on the scale of China, how to deal with them. And that created somewhat of a gap for the Chinese. So to say that the Chinese are just flouting the rules on the subsidies agreement, that's not really, really true. They were very, very astute in finding the gaps. And also, in the protocol of accession, did not address particularly questions of transparency. So up to this day, nobody really knows the extent and the depth of Chinese state subsidies. And that is the heart of the problem.
So let's just understand it in a way that people who are outside of the intricate area that you know so well can understand it. It's like having a competitor who is supported by the state and subsidized by the state through finance, and perhaps there are many ways that if you are a big, strong player, as the Chinese are, that you can subsidize it. And it's worked really well for China. They have flooded the world with their products. They've generated masses of amounts of exports. And the Americans have maybe played along with this to a degree by allowing not just the Chinese to come into their markets, but by offshoring a lot of their manufacturing. So Donald Trump comes to power on the back of a lot of people who don't have jobs that would have been there had the Chinese not been so astute in bending the rules, if you like, or finding the gaps in the market. Is that a fair way to describe it?
Yes. Yes, no, very much so. And it's also, it's now fine to be clear with hindsight what happened during the Chinese succession, but it created a gap for them. And also there were U.S. companies that pushed certain issues during the accession negotiations for their own benefit. And it seems to me there was a little bit of an imbalance that certain sectors pushed harder and other critical sectors in the U.S. with high intensity of labor were not that active. So one can argue that their rights were not that much protected in the negotiations. And that left a little bit of an imbalance in the process, because some of the U.S. companies made huge profits in China, because the whole idea was also, and that's also an imbalance where sort of, I would say inexperience, but a little bit of naivety came into play. And that is that the whole idea was, okay, we open our market to the Chinese, but they also have to open their market. And that's a market of 1.3 billion people. So there was a huge opportunity, potential opportunity for U.S. industries. But then it became a little bit of one-way traffic, but to a large extent, which caused huge, huge imbalances. So there are a number of issues that, if you put it together, there's a very, very clear picture of what happened. And of course, what also did not help at all was the dispute settlement system of the WTO, where the U.S. and other countries complained at the WTO about some of the Chinese practices. And in the WTO, you have a deal dispute settlement system, the panel states, the tribunal stage, and then you have the appeal states, the appellate body stage. And in many of the very pertinent cases, the appellate body interpreted the rules as, or the provisions in the different agreements in such a way that China got a little bit of a free card. And that's why the U.S. then started to object, and in the end, caused the demise of the appellate body as we knew it. Now, okay, one can argue about interpretation, legal interpretations. It's either this way or that way. But that's another topic. Let's not go into the detail of that.
But this is so interesting. You were there. You saw it. You were at a very senior position at the World Trade Organization. And it must have frustrated you that the one grouping seemed to be a little more astute, perhaps, in working the system. I don't want to say gaming the system, but certainly the Chinese, from what you've told us, appeared to have maybe sent smarter people there or better negotiators, because they came out with a better deal, and the imbalances continued to the point where, I guess at some point in time, something had to give.
Yes, exactly. No, you hit the nail on its head. It was bound to happen, so I'm not surprised on what's been happening the last couple of weeks or months. It's just the intensity and the way how the Trump administration is going about it. But it was bound to happen sometime or the other, because the WTO members have been discussing for 10 years to reform the system, but they've made little, if any, progress. Now, will they ever make progress as a past insider? No, there's no way that the WTO will be able to reform itself. To have 166 members, they work on a consensus basis. How are we going to get any discussions going on very basic issues, even on the agenda? It's not going to happen. So the train smash was on its way. It was just a question of when. And the Trump administration has now sort of pulled the trigger to get the process going. So what's going to come out of it, that's another issue.
How do you interpret what Donald Trump did in the past week? Many people are saying he has he's been using the strategies or tactics that he outlined in his book, The Art of the Deal, that he's actually trying to make a better deal for the United States. Given the background you've given us, that they are on the back foot and they have been losing ground, something had to be done. Has he done the right thing, in your opinion?
That's a difficult one. I think if you look at the art of the deal, yes, he's been following his sort of script. Now, my first question then is the script, does it suit the forum and the issues? And there I have a serious issue, because when you negotiate in a multilateral forum, it all goes about trust. I have to trust you. I have to build your trust. Because the way how these things sort of work is we negotiate on something, a trade issue. I get to know what your position is. You get to know what my position is. I show you a little bit my cards. I'm not going to show you all my cards, and I'm not going to tell you what my bottom line is. But I have to trust you a little bit, and vice versa. And in that way, you go to your principals and you try to strike an agreement. So I know a little bit how far I can push you. So, and that's not the way our business people negotiate. And then, of course, after you've done a deal, you'll have to come back. I can't fight you and have a lot of blood on the floor, and then tomorrow I have to pretend we're friends, because then I need you as a friend in another negotiation, or I have to strike another deal. So once bitten, twice shy. So how do you sort of reconcile that with art of the deal? I find serious difficulties. And if you look at what's been going on in Washington, D.C. right now, my information is that there are about 70 countries have requested consultations with the U.S. government. 70. Now, Israel, the prime minister was in D.C. a couple of days ago. He didn't get anything. My information is he didn't get anything on trade, or if he did get anything, it was highly confidential or nobody knows. Vietnam is in town. Korea is in town, and Japan with huge delegations. The Vietnamese delegation is led by a vice prime minister. So, and they're trying to get a bit of a deal. Now, 70 countries, how do you negotiate with them? Last night, Trump said, or it was daylight in daytime still in D.C. in an informal press conference in the Oval Office, well, in the cabinet room, he said that, with all the law firms that we've put on the spot, they've promised to give us hundreds of millions of dollars free time pro bono work. So we're going to get them, the clever lawyers of Washington, to assist us to negotiate with the other countries. Now, how do you negotiate? It takes time. It's not something they do overnight. But the way how he's doing it, and sort of that's what they've been telling me from Washington, is that you come into the room and then they tell you, okay, what can you offer us? And they have this thick book, compendium that the U.S. Trade Representative's office has compiled of all the sins of the countries, not only tariffs, non-tariff measures as well. And then they say, okay, so what are you going to do? So it's almost like the old Chinese emperor system with the tributes. You know, I come and I sing the praises of the emperor, and then depending on what I offer, I get trade rights. It's almost the same. It's a little bit of a weird analogy, but so you have to say what you can offer. And then they say, okay, thanks very much. We'll come back to you. And then, of course, they put pressure on you. So then the question is, are these sort of real negotiations? And that is something not new to the world of trade, but that is exactly what the multilateral trading system tries to address, because otherwise you get ruled by the powerful, and then the grass get trampled by fighting elephants.
Sure, what a story. So let's look at South Africa's situation. The U.S., the White House has said we don't like BEE. Well, there's a very good argument to get rid of BEE. We've heard from the Institute of Race Relations, who are as neutral as you can get in these matters, that it's a terrible thing for the country. And we know the economy's been going backwards. We know we need to reform. Might it be an opportunity for the South African government of national unity to say, okay, these are the things we've got to change in the country, including BEE. There are many other reforms as well. We've got to do it because America is saying we have to. And if we then can go back to our constituents and say, sorry, you know, if we don't go according to the emperor, we're going to be a wasteland. I think Fikile Mbulela yesterday said at an ANC event that this will become a rubble country. There'll just be rubble left. So maybe there's a way of looking at it as an opportunity to use the other party to fix things that we've been struggling to fix because of political restraints. What's your thought on that?
That's a tough one. You see, if you look at the South African government approach, my sort of personal feeling is that the switch to the East was made many years ago. And the attitude or deep down is that what we can get from the US, that's a bonus. Now, okay, I know we're still very much tied to the US and to Europe, historical reasons, sort of our big trading partners, but there's a huge effort, or has been a huge effort by the government to diversify towards the East. So I think it might be a little bit of a hard sell in the inside of the government right now, because the ANC can always say that, okay, US, so you're actually against reform and undoing the injustices of the past. So that's politically a very, very difficult one. A way to do is, because of my first response when I heard that there are already 7 countries on the list, where will South Africa fit in? Perhaps it's not a bad thing, because the Minister of Trade, Industry or Competition said that South Africa is not going to retaliate. It's just to sit tight for a little bit of a while, because to see what's going on in DC. On the one hand, you want to be first to get a good deal. But on the other hand, the problem for people who might strike a deal soon is, will they get assurances that they will not be hit by another tariff hike by President Trump? So you put all your things on the table. Trump said, okay, I bank it. And tomorrow he comes back with another 5 or 20% tariff. So it's very, very difficult, unpredictable time. So I would say, let's not mix our apples and pears. Let's sort of just sort out the basic stuff. And then once the US ambassador is settled in Pretoria and South African ambassador in Washington settled in, then to look a little bit wider. But I think to put everything into the pot now,
is going to be very, very difficult because the way, well, I suppose you know how Washington works, it's contacts, contacts, contacts with a big C. Either personal contacts, by particularly from ambassador's side, but also from other senior officials. The network is absolutely critical. Okay, if you don't have a good network, then the second line is you go for the lobbyists. Now, there are many of them in Washington, but they have their price. If you want to have access to the USTR right now, through a lobbyist, it's going to cost you a hell of a lot of money. But you can get access, but it's going to cost you. And it's things are so confusing at the moment, because you'd also recall that what happened 2 days ago when the markets tumbled, and particularly what was critical for Trump to make his about turn on the 90 days was the fact that the Treasury bonds, the rate went up. Now, that, as you know, the Treasury bonds used to be the safe haven. Whenever there were instabilities in the market, the investors would go for T-bonds. And then the rate of the T-bonds will fall. And then you'll have a sort of, that was a stabilizing factor. But what happened now was that all of a sudden, the demand for T-bonds went down. And the rate went up. And that must have scared the Trump administration, because Greer, the USDR, was in Congress on the very same day, I think it was Wednesday, explaining to, I think it was the House or the Senators, what they're doing. At that very same time, the president announced the delay. And the same morning, Treasury Secretary Bessent, he was still defending the tariffs. And a few hours later, the president made a bow turn. Now, on that score, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, because this whole thing is all about China with a big C. China. But if you isolate the Chinese, you're in serious trouble. Then you have 1.4 billion Chinese against you. And surely you don't want that. So if China is lumped together with other countries, then they might complain, but they won't get aggressive. So that's why all friends of the U.S. were also included. Well, that's my take on it. That's why the EU was also included. Now, the EU then said, okay, we're thinking of retaliating, but they did not retaliate. And then the announcement came. So that was out of jail card for Trump on the EU, because now he can tell the Chinese, but the EU did not retaliate. You retaliated. So by default, China has isolated themselves, which changes the ball game. But there was sort of a little bit of a really bumpy road the last couple of days. Whether it's going to get smoother or not, I don't know. It's risky days.
Johan, if you look at it again as a neutral observer, and given the background that China has gamed the system, they've had all the advantages, Trump is saying no more, we want to claw back some of those advantages, reindustrialize America, etc. Is this likely to remain a situation where China is isolated? Because if you can't, as Chinese, export into the United States, you got a heck of a lot of products that you're going to be wanting to export elsewhere, including South Africa and other friends, or even, they don't even have to be friends. Chinese goods are going to be flooding into other markets. Is that not a recipe for even more instability going forward? Because if other countries now decide we can't allow Chinese steel at a fraction of the price of what we can produce it here coming into the country, and we've got to put up barriers or trade barriers against China as well, it could really escalate into something very dangerous.
Yes, no, I agree with you, because the US can say, okay, we've sort of isolated ourselves, we can manage, But what about the rest of the world? And I agree with you, because you will find massive, massive trade diversion. And the first diversion would be to, the way that I see it, is to the EU, because they have a significant market. And then wherever the Chinese companies can sell their products, they're going to flood them. And the question then is whether you have the instruments to address these things. And that's where the WTO comes a little bit short on what we call the trade remedies. And that was my particular field of expertise, is these instruments are there, but they take time. You can't just act and block imports, but okay, and increase tariffs, but okay, the US has done it. So is this now going to be a free for all? If I have a flood of products coming from wherever into my market and it's going to kill my industry, will politicians not say, okay, I have a national emergency now, and therefore I suspend the WTO provisions against the exporter, whoever that is going to be, to sort things out? But that's sort of also another sort of very delicate issue. Now, it's really, really scary times. Make no, there's no question in my mind about it. Whether now Trump apparently is going to meet President Xi in July, but that's now April, May, June. That's 3 months away. And, you know, you can do a lot of damage to the world trading system and to trade and to countries. And I find it very, very explosive. What can happen very soon. Now, of course, one can also argue, okay, the EU will then put a lot of pressure on the US administration to go softer on China. So, but then what's also interesting is the Chinese have been preparing for this. They haven't been caught with their pants down, perhaps the extent of the measures, but they've already started a couple of years ago in their 5-year plan programs to have a bifurcated system, to continue exporting in large quantities, but also to develop demand inside China, that the Chinese absorb more of their own products. Now, that is different to what happened in Japan in the early 70s, when the U.S. faced a similar situation with Japan. Now, Japan did not have a huge domestic market. Well, to this day, they're only, 125 million people. In China, you have 1.3 billion. So, and coincidentally, on Wednesday, the Chinese, one of the vice premiers, Li, met with industry people and people from think tanks, the discussion that they had was how to accelerate increased domestic demand in China, because the Chinese have the highest level of savings in the world, or one of the highest in any case. So they're sitting, the Chinese households, they sit on piles and piles of money, and they need to spend it. So they just need to be activated a little bit. So I think the extent of the problem is such, and the repercussions and implications such, that the US and China absolutely will have to find what the French call cohabitation. We're competitors, but the US wants to change the rules, and the US, if they can get the rules changed, then perhaps we can move forward. But then, of course, China will say, oh, but I've done nothing wrong. I've just played the game according to the WTO rules. So, you know, go away. So it's going to be very, very tough bargaining.
Talking about this issue, not in specifics, but generally, to Helen Ziller earlier this week, she said we're going to have to box clever, and we're going to have to be very, very careful in the way that we manage things. That sounds like excellent advice from what you've told us now, because every new layer of the onion that you unpeel as you go deeper into this conversation tells me that we don't even know what we don't know as members of the public. But do the South African government know as much as what you've outlined for us now? Are they fully aware? Helen Ziller is, because at the Biz News conference, she certainly gave us a wonderful overview of where the world is. But from what you've explained now, not much of this seems to be hitting certainly in the public discourse.
Yes, no, I think cool heads and clever people are now called for, and don't rush in where angels fear to tread. Just think it through very, very carefully, because if you trot off to Washington right now, they're going to demand a hell of a lot from you. And are you prepared to put all non-tariff measures and all these things on the table? Which ones are you going to put on the table? Have you consulted with your own industries? Which ones are the more important ones? And this is not something that you can decide in a very short space of time. You need to think it through very, very carefully. But of course, business people would say, well, time is of the essence. We simply don't have time. But I think there's no alternative right now, because if you make the wrong move, the U.S. administration might decide to hit you even harder, because, as we know, the rules-based approach is somewhat, let's call it rickety in Washington right now.
Well, we got 90 days. Let's use those 90 days very well as South Africa Inc. Johan Himan is an international trade expert who has spent a career in international trade, 17 years in the World Trade Organization before that, senior positions in South Africa in that area. Thank you for your insights, Johan. We will be calling on you, you can be certain, in the time ahead as we go along this bumpy road. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.